This is an interesting time of the year. For some, it's quite difficult. The clocks changed last week. The evenings now draw in about us. The church celebrates All Saints Day, technically last Wednesday, and the day after, All Souls Day. Next week, we'll watch and take part in poignant Remembrance Day ceremonies and think of all those who have lost their lives due to violence, war and terror. Those who are bereaved can find this time of the year difficult, and the run-up to Christmas can heighten that sense of loss. However, as Christians, we believe that death is not the end, and the twin festivals of All Saints and All Souls can play their part in reminding us of the hope of resurrection to a new heaven and a new earth that our first hymn described, and which we cling to in the face of loss and bereavement. Since the earliest days of the church, we've had to wrestle with the reality of death and the hope of resurrection described in the book of Revelation. We discussed and thought a little earlier about the concept of saints and said that in the earliest church, martyrs were automatically recognized as such. Our first reading from Revelation is clearly where the early church got that idea from. Here, the great multitude of saints from every nation are those who were persecuted and martyred, ones who now sing praises to God. But Revelation is a rather challenging book, and one that we often shy away from, because, well, it addresses a reality for us in the West that we don't face, the reality of persecution. The book was written when Christians faced oppression and martyrdom, at least sporadically in the Roman Empire, for their beliefs. Revelation uses a style of imagery and writing which is rather uncomfortable to read, and many of those who have tried to interpret it end up teaching some very odd things indeed. And it criticizes empire. The Roman Empire was a mixed blessing for the church. Its internal communications, peace and order meant it was easy to travel to spread the gospel. The empire was, as all empires are, unjust. So let's look at each of these areas of discomfort to see what progress we can make with our reading. Thankfully, we live in safety and security in the UK. No one is bothered by our ethnicity, religion, political opinion, sexuality, or gender. From the perspective of history, we're living in an unusual time. Our forebears in the churches which led to the formation of the URC experienced discrimination and persecution because of their understanding of the faith and how they wished to worship. But we're also unusual in terms of our world. In the West, we live in security, with the rule of law, liberal democracy and wealth, which insulates us from the cruel realities of our world. People are persecuted for their faith, their political opinions, their gender and how they love in many parts of our world. A tiny number managed to get here for sanctuary. So perhaps this passage can give hope to those who live with persecution. Perhaps its promise of a future freedom is one they can hold on to. And perhaps this vision is one that we can help bring about. And then there's a paradox with the book of Revelation. Most Christians are understandably rather wary of it. Many non-Christians are fascinated by it. There's a wealth of material on the internet, in films, which seek to interpret this or that passage in Revelation and to find some meaning or prophecy for how our world's to go. Very few of us would like to live on a street if our house was number 666, for example. Most Christians, however, possibly because of some very strange interpretations that are around, tend to shy away from the book. And I think we make a mistake when we do that, especially when many in our wider society are fascinated by it. What we need to bear in mind, and more importantly communicate, is that the book relies heavily on the writer's imagination, and we're drawn into his world, and his world was dangerous. He uses imagery sometimes to obscure his meaning, but much of what he wrote is crystal clear. The writer sketches an image in this passage of the saints being safe with the Lord, safe to love, safe to worship. Later in the book, he casts an image of the new heaven and the new earth, which will come when all will live with the Lord without fear, where death and sickness and mourning and crying will be no more. The saints have the privilege of being the forerunners of what we will all experience in due course. It's a book of comfort. And then there's this empire thing. It's easy to be critical of empires when we live in a country which no longer has one. The Jewish people at the time of the New Testament were precarious citizens of the Roman Empire, just about tolerated as a legal religion, but slowly, with the church coming along, the separation between Christians and Jews, and then the Christians finding themselves on the wrong side of the Roman law. The church was persecuted for two reasons. First, it didn't take part in the imperial religion, and so was seen as antisocial. But more vitally, it was persecuted because it made some surprising claims. That little phrase, "Jesus is Lord," to us seems really ordinary. But in an empire, Caesar was Lord. All prosperity, health, and safety was bound up in Roman thinking with the emperor, who was often declared a god after he died, in a process not unlike contemporary saint-making. Christianity offered a different view of the world. Salvation belongs to God, not Caesar. All other imperial claimants have been dethroned, or at least spiritually defeated. In our context, that means the powers and dominions that seek to rule our world for their own end, the people who seek to enrich themselves at the expense of others, the social systems that seek to increase division between rich and poor, will one day be dethroned, judged, and found wanting. The saints, the persecuted ones, understood this, and their loyalty to Jesus instead of Caesar cost them their lives. But there is a pitfall we need to avoid when we think about Revelation and its promise of resurrection. Revelation offers hope of a better world, but that better world seems to be the next one. It seems to be a new realm far beyond the cruel realities of our current age. So we might conceive of salvation to mean an escape from this life, from this world and all its despair, degradation, injustice, and oppression. Many people who are poor and oppressed often think like this. Yet this otherworldliness, this pie in the sky, is rather good news for those in power. It legitimizes the status quo. It's easy for the powerful to buy into the pie in the sky promise of a new world as they keep their power and their wealth in the here and now. It isn't a sign of sainthood to opt out of the struggle for a better world. It isn't holy to ignore the needs of those around us. As we just sung, the saints are those who march with events and turn them in God's way. True sanctity calls the world to judgment. True holiness reminds people that Jesus is Lord, and that means there is a judgment and an accounting to come, themes we look at again and again in Advent. True sainthood reminds the world it has to change. In his marvellous book, The Power and the Glory, Graham Greene followed the progress of the last priest in a particular state in Mexico during a period of persecution. Greene describes the priest as a whiskey priest, we'd now say an alcoholic. He also had a daughter from an illicit relationship. But despite his frailty and his foibles, he travelled around from place to place, hearing confessions, celebrating mass, baptising children, marrying couples. Eventually, he was caught by the authorities. He refused to renounce his faith, and unlike another priest, Padre Jose, he refuses to marry except a state pension and settle down as a tame example of a safe priest. So, towards the end of the book, he was executed. As he approached his execution, it occurred to him that it would have been quite easy to have been a saint. He realised, paradoxically, because he's being martyred and so will be declared a saint anyway, that it's the little things in life that mark our holiness. That surely is the point behind our gospel reading from the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus took the everyday things of life, being poor, mourning, being meek, thirsting for justice, being merciful, being pure, being a peacemaker, suffering persecution and being reviled, and turns each of these into places of holiness. We are blessed, or happy, as the Good News Version puts it, when we realise that we can encounter God in the everyday things of life, even the awful things like persecution and division. My problem with how much of the church recognises saints is that it cleans them up and holds them up as heroic examples of faith. The whiskey priest that's implied at the end of the book will become a saint, but the version of his life the church will promulgate won't bear much resemblance to his fallen reality. The church must make people safe, and in so doing makes them very different to us. Yet the saints are just like me and you. They were grumpy. They struggled to follow Jesus in the everyday things of life, and many of them we probably wouldn't like very much. Those who were truly revolutionary, like the martyred Archbishop Oscar Romero, gunned down by the government while celebrating Mass in El Salvador, disturbed the church for so long that they only just got round to declaring him a saint, and only with this Pope, who's quite radical. Revelation urges us to look for a better world, but Jesus in Matthew's Gospel shows us how to make that world better in the here and now. Our hope of resurrection, however, does not mean that we need to glorify the suffering in the world. Those who are persecuted, beaten, raped, and despised need to find the strength in God to resist their oppression and to find salvation and wholeness now. This isn't to be found in the glorification of their suffering, but in finding the grace to put that suffering to an end. The saints were, I think, quite edgy people who disturbed the status quo. The saints of the earliest church and the Reformation were so edgy that they were killed. Others pushed the boundaries of what the church was about and found ways to interpret the gospel in their own contexts. Biblical sanctity will always disturb the status quo, will always look to the better world which is to come, and will view the struggles in our world for freedom and justice as the coming of the kingdom. We know that our struggles for sanctity, our yearning for justice and righteousness, our desire for that new heaven and that new earth to come, won't happen in our own lifetime. The promise is to come when we and all God's saints will be raised to new life. This promise of resurrection, however, needs to spur us on now as we seek God's face in our world, as we work to make his coming kingdom of love and justice real. Surrounded by the saints as a great cloud of witnesses, we can draw our inspiration from them as we obey Jesus' command to follow him, just as they did. Amen.